Welcome to the South Platte River Committee of Denver City Council. This session of the South Platte River Committee begins now.
Of the day. It is the South Platte River Committee on Wednesday, June 11th. I'm your committee vice chair and council member at large, Sarah Parity. We will start with council member intros to my left.
Sorry. That's fine. Denver's perfect 10.
Councilmember Darren Watson, Representative Fine, District 9.
Good afternoon, Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver, District 1.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
And I'll pause in case we have any members online. I'm not sure that we do.
Nope.
Alrighty. So then with that, we have two presentations today, two items on consent. First, we have the team from the Denver Housing Authority presenting on the Sun Valley, and you guys can introduce yourselves and then go ahead and take it away. Thank you.
My name is Renee Martinez-Stone. I'm the Chief Strategy and Planning Officer at the Denver Housing Authority.
And I'm Erin Clark, Chief Real Estate Investment Officer at Denver Housing Authority. Our CEO is on his way, and we have some additional team members in the audience.
Great. Thank you so much. Are you all good to get started, or do you want to
pause and wait for? Okay, we can jump in. I'm kicking us off here.
Thanks, Renee.
You bet. Next slide. All right, what we're here to talk about today is the transformation of the Sun Valley neighborhood. This property began with 333 aging homes, a concentration of 1,400 very low-income residents, a light rail station that provided promising connectivity investment at the time, limited access to healthy amenities, services, and healthy food. So in 2015, well, actually in 2013, we began a Choice Neighborhood Initiative planning grant, and then we pursued additional implementation funding from HUD in 2015 following some analysis. Next slide. Part of that analysis included, while we were redeveloping Mariposa, DHA innovated a resident-focused approach called the Healthy Living Tool. This became a national model called the Healthy Living Initiative. And what this did is it made sure that redevelopment aligned with the needs, indicators of health, and specific resident needs. So it looked at health indicators, social determinants of health, including safety, inclusion, ability to interact with others, isolation, those things that we learned were making things hard for residents. We focused both on quantitative as well as qualitative issues. And what this was aimed to do is that through our approach, phasing early investments that would connect to residents through a number of investments, like the People Center, a garden, those early threads that would help residents to understand that this redevelopment was for them, that we weren't doing it for someone else or for residents to come. In addition, this work would help make sure that the built environment, including the blocks, the sites, the buildings, were sustainable, healthy, and provided activity, interaction, joy, art, cultural representation, and access to essential program. Next slide. Some of the things that we learned in early 2015 when a health survey was conducted would then inform the whole process of implementing. In 2018, a full healthy living initiative for Sun Valley was implemented with assessments, surveys, interviews, quantitative data, setting baselines and campaigns that would address social and mental well-being, the natural environment, the built environment, and what we could do to support active living and other healthy interactions, access and inclusion, including economic mobility and access to services, as well as safety, which is often an ongoing concern. Next slide. One of the critical elements of the master planning for the transformation of Sun Valley was a focus on children and families. So there was a desire for open space that would create opportunity for children to exercise, play, experience nature, and interact, and potentially even garden. Those conversations started early in the master planning and then continued in more detail 2017 through 2020. In 2019, Denver Parks and Rec joined that effort that started really looking at data and how that should drive our understanding of needs and demand for park facilities. That was later followed up. So what's represented here was a part of the game plan that showed demand for Sun Valley. That was followed up in 2024 with an additional study that looked at more recreation-specific indicators, but still indicated a very high demand and need for parks and recreation space within Sun Valley. Sorry, I did run for my parking
space. I couldn't breathe for a second. Slides were just rude.
Presenting immediately. I'm not always this out of breath.
Well, we can give Renee a moment to breathe by welcoming Council Pro Tem Mel Campbell and DHA CEO Joaquin Citron Vega, whose birthday I understand it to be. So happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Deep breath for everyone.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Renee.
You bet. Thank you. So part of DHA's effort, especially in redevelopment, is that we not only integrate the needs of health, but we're consistently engaging with residents, communities, partners, and stakeholders to have input on the phase design, projects, the details, the programming, and construction. And so a part of that effort not only included on-site offices, where our community connectors could serve staff, help them to evaluate their relocation options and come back, exercising their right to return. But we started programs and we engaged in, we had focus groups, we had community advisory meetings, we had events, so that the fun and the focus on residents happened even before buildings started to be built. So that, there's one more slide. And always, as central to this, the North Star of our redevelopment is to focus on the community priorities that were set early on that would mean that we would deliver benefits and outcomes that were desired by the early residents. So those included youth and education, really bringing in and solving the issue of access to food, which was solved with gardens and a small grocery that we have delivered. Addressing that opportunity, a mixed income and variety of housing types for intentional housing, the parks and open space, and that sustainable infrastructure, both inside and out, to ensure a healthy, sustainable community. And so to describe that in a little more detail, I'm going to hand off to my colleague, Erin.
Thank you so much, Renee. Thank you for having us. So yes, I get to talk about how we took all of that amazing, intentional, community-grounded work and what were the needs of the people and how that is now reflected in the changes that we've made physically in terms of housing and infrastructure. And of course, what's next being Riverfront Park. And then after me, Joaquin will share more to close us out of the impact of all of this work. So the redevelopment itself, we really think this is key, that we have been rebuilding for access and for opportunities. So just as a high-level framing, this redevelopment work has redeveloped 333 former public housing units, the Sun Valley Homes, into now 965 units of housing, apartments and townhomes, across seven buildings, and with additional land to be sold to market rate partners to bring in another around 1,000 units. So going from a concentration of public housing to a truly mixed income community. And I think what's so special about Sun Valley, well, so many things are so special about Sun Valley, but with respect to the South Platte River specifically, that we are helping to kind of be part of that change of turning, instead of turning our backs to the river, really viewing it as an amenity, and grouping ourselves with what's to come at Ball Arena and what's happening at National Western and all of these large-scale redevelopments happening up and down our riverfront. But in this case, it is grounded in a community that was multi-generational and that is starting with and really focused around deeply affordable housing. So this whole redevelopment, again, was made possible by leveraging $34 million in a grant from the federal government, from HUD, That then was used to leverage our partnership with you all here at the City and County of Denver through the D3 bond program. Just over $60 million of that has been used in these seven buildings that we've used. And from that, the federal dollars, the city or city dollars through the Affordable Housing Fund and bonding through the Housing Authority has been used to leverage up to over $500 million in development. So that is a ratio of 14 to 1. So this is a really good return on investment. And that we just think that's a really important message to share. The image you'll see here on the left is the original Sun Valley Homes, those red roofs there, and the curvilinear streets, kind of that more suburban context in this urban location. To the right is the redevelopment plan itself. So all of the kind of brightly colored buildings are the ones that DHA has placed here. And then you'll see along the river to the east are the original concepts for the Riverfront Park. But importantly, again, grounding this in community and in the people, a community that has historically been underinvested, but has such a rich cultural ties with 33 different cultural backgrounds and 30 different languages spoken. And so it's been very key for us in looking at what we're doing to change the roadways and to bring in housing and services that we're grounded in making sure that this is still a community where these folks are welcome and feel at home. So these are the pretty pictures of the seven buildings that we've built in the past 6 years. So we've built them in three phases. Gateway North and Gateway South were 187 units of housing that were constructed between 2021 and 2023. Greenhouse and Thrive, that was another 264 units. Those were constructed between 2021 and 2023. And then we're in our final phase now, phase three. Jolie, Soul, and Flow, those have been constructed between 2023 and this year, 2025. So those three buildings are all opening this year. We are delivering 514 new units of housing in just this calendar year, 2025. We have already had two successful groundbreaking events for Jolie and for Soul. Welcome you all to join us on August 7th for our capstone kind of groundbreaking event for Flow, which will be a senior high-rise, 100% affordable for older adults and those with disabilities. And with that, we're going to have a block party and just kind of a neighborhood celebration at the end of the summer, again, August 7th. So watch your email inboxes for information about that. And also critically, that this has all been built for... Yes, it's more housing, so there's new residents coming in, but there is a first right of return for all of those original Sun Valley residents, and we are far exceeding national expectations in terms of the return rate, which has been really wonderful. So in terms of the South Platte River, just my last piece of this is to share the infrastructure investments as well. We see everything, including affordable housing, as an investment in needed infrastructure and public need. But here we're talking about the specific things that we've put in the ground, the land work. So you'll see we have subdivided the area, created a grid where there was not one before to improve connectivity. Previously, 10th Avenue, for example, which comes down, actually crosses Federal, is one of the few places you can get across and into Sun Valley. It used to stop at Decatur Street. Now it cuts through all the way to the river and to the future Riverfront Park. All of this is, we've made sure to not only create new rights of way, we've increased the size of the water lines and the sewer lines. So all of those also used to follow those curvilinear streets. They are now have been improved and replaced in these new rights of way. We have water quality along the or within the sidewalks, things of that nature, and vaults, enhanced vaults for how the water flows kind of downhill into this area underground and ultimately is cleaned to a degree before it enters the South Platte River. So what's next? The park itself. So we call it the Riverfront Park. That is not the official name. This will ultimately be a city park, and we'll go through those naming processes with community input for what the ultimate name of the park will be. But we, you'll see here, just in context, having our Block 3, Jolie and Flo, and a food incubator that we're building there as well, a commissary kitchen. We'll have roll-up doors that have nice indoor-outdoor space. We are constructing Alcott Street now, which will be a shared street, so kind of more of a festival street. Yes, cars can drive there, but really it's built for pedestrians, for people walking and rolling, and as a great gateway to the park. And so on this next slide, we want to just share some of the details there. You can see the imagery. The park itself came out of the original general development plan for the area. So it is ultimately to be around 11 acres. We've broken it into two phases, with the first phase will be under construction in 2026. So we hope to be having a grand opening of that at the end of 2026. The first phase is just over 5 acres. And you'll see this also is intended to include, to really meet some of those early healthy living initiative goals and the GROW principles of environmental health, looking at equity and inclusion, mobility and connectivity, physical, mental, and social health. The first phase is more, I've called it kind of the contemplative part of the park. Phase two will be kind of the more active part with play fields, things of that nature. And finally, just that this has all been a really critical city housing authority partnership. So this is just to show basic sources and uses. We did execute between our two organizations an intergovernmental agreement last year for phase one of the park with a budget of $8.5 million. So the city is contributing $3 million. $2 million of that is from the Elevate bond dollars, and another $1 million from the capital improvement program funds. DHA is contributing the remaining $5.5 million, the lion's share of that coming from the fact that we have created an urban renewal area here and tax increment financing, so it would be dollars coming through that mechanism in addition to other DHA funds. We're the ones overseeing the construction, but doing that in partnership with our counterparts at Denver Parks and Rec in approving design, having improved the general contractor, and ultimately, as I noted earlier, this will be a park dedicated to the city and operated by the City and County of Denver. So just to end on our timeline, we've approved that budget for phase one, and we are looking to start construction at the end of this year, and again to complete construction at the end of next year. So with that, I want to turn things over to the birthday boy to talk about impact.
Thank you, Erin, and thank you for having us today. And
I just want to say really quickly, we have probably about 10 minutes before we want to shift over to questions, and so I think it's probably perfectly timed because I know we're like two-thirds through the slides.
Yeah, I think we have just two or three slides left.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that I will be very brief and intend to allow opportunities to questions, which is going to be definitely more productive than anything that I have to say. But I just want to say that you know, we have explained the Sun Valley redevelopment project from the perspective and the context of what was the existing neighborhood back then, and then again, you know, what were the needs that were identified by the individuals, the residents, the community, through a community responsive planning and development approach that was you know, exercised back then, and through those needs. Erin just explained the opportunities that were identified. Again, in an exercise in which all of us, I am including myself because I am proud of all of these efforts, but in the practice, it was all of you, right, that took the opportunity to listen to the community. And from there, you know, the impact that all of this work represents. I want to add something else. We're talking about a promise, and it's a promise that has been alive for about 10 to 12 years now. I am proud to say that I am joining DHA, Erin, Renee, and all of you in a juncture in which we are actually delivering upon that promise, and we are delivering 965 apartments, basically triplicating the density that was existing back then. We had a hugely and largely disinvested community. We are creating and delivering a mixed income community that is answering the question that concentration of poverty and gentrification is posing upon all of us. So this is an answer to that. But most importantly, that we took an opportunity to listen and to support a vision that is coming from the community, not only to provide housing, but to do that within a strong foundation of economic development investments. And we have the food incubator, as you know. We have Decatur Fresh providing fresh produce. We have opportunities for business, opportunities for our residents. And also, we are delivering together a neighborhood that is providing vibrancy to Denver. So we are providing a neighborhood that is not only going to be a better place for our people, but we'll add some additional assets like the Riverfront Park project, which is not only going to amplify the opportunities for everybody that is living within the city and county of Denver, but also as a hub for additional economic activity in terms of supporting small businesses, enterprises, and the likes, and also opening the doors for others within other jurisdictions to come to Sun Valley and to enjoy the Riverfront Park. So I want to just to close with this, because I believe that is truly important. Phase one is on track, but phase two is where the full transformation takes root. And as I expressed yesterday during my deposition at the Vibrant Denver Executive Committee meeting, and on behalf of our Sun Valley community, we are requesting $20 million in bond funding to complete completely delivering and fulfilling our promise. I want to say that this number is well-grounded. It reflects detailed budgeting from phase one and accounts for fully considered environmental conditions on the site. And I want to be very assertive on this that I am saying. It is important to know that DHA and our brownfield consultants have a high level of confidence in this estimate. Up to this point, DHA has invested over $7 million to prepare the site, including environmental cleanup and design. And more meaningfully, our partners at the city, alongside with you council members, have already committed funding to deliver on both the larger Sun Valley redevelopment project, as Erin was explaining prior, and phase one of the South Platte Riverfront Park project. And in closing, I want to say we're ready. We are ready. The community is ready. This is the right time for our collective to step forward to fulfill a decade of partnership and promise. This is what is important. It's about the promise to our community. And I believe that we have the ingredients to fulfill that promise. So we have the plan. We can talk about that. We have the support, we can talk about that, and we have the momentum, and we can talk about that. So lastly, I will say, let's honor the trust that we have built. Let's deliver lasting equity, health, and economic vitality, which is truly important. And let's keep building the future, but keep building futures for our families. And as it was 10 to 12 years ago when the first choice planning grant came, let's build this together. I will close with that. Thank you for the opportunity, and we open ourselves to any questions that you may have.
Perfect. Thank you all so much. I'm, as someone who came onto council recently, it's really, really helpful to get this focused kind of overview, which is why we have this committee. And I will say the kids from the Sun Valley Youth Center have been coming to council frequently and testifying beautifully, and they brought us fidget toys, so we love them. With that, I will start the queue with Councilmember Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation, and thanks for the project itself. So we're considering the Vibrant Denver Bond. We're also considering the Downtown Development Authority. And in those conversations, we're talking about taking some money and making it more money. So I think your slide about turning $34 million into $500 million is compelling. Will you kind of go into that a little bit more? Because I heard HUD was 34, city was like 3.2, you pitched in a few million. How is it 500 million?
So 500 million for the full redevelopment. So 34 million in a HUD grant, and then we were adding the 60 million from the Affordable Housing Fund from the city that's gone into all of the housing.
That's 94.
What?
That's 94.
That's 94. 3 million is then in the park. There's been in so. The housing alone has been around $450 million. So a lot of that is that we've leveraged those original dollars into the tax credits, the private loans, other, you know, attracting other dollars that have gotten us to be able to build those 965 units. And then on the infrastructure side, so if we're looking, oops. The map is gone. So we've had two major. Yay! So we've had two major infrastructure projects. One being between 13th Avenue on the north and West 11th on the south, just below Fairview Elementary. That was also Elevate bond dollars. And so that was with the timing of us doing the redevelopment. We contracted to do work that the city was planning to do in terms of realigning West 13th, adding bike lanes, things of that nature. So that's around $13 million worth of work there. And in the Sun Valley redevelopment area, so that's south of 11th, with 11th at the north, down to 9th Avenue between Decatur and the river. That is over $25 million in additional infrastructure work there as well.
If I may, briefly, that is a great question. That requires a very complex answer. I want to put within context, this redevelopment project consists of seven different buildings, and the answer to your question is contained within the capital stack of each one of those projects that we are happy to provide that information, which is going to provide the level of detail that Council Member Hines, you are asking for us to provide. So I just wanted to put that for context, but happy to provide the additional detail.
And just the nature of the question is not to say where's the money. It's more to lift you up and say this is a success case of how we can leverage our money with other people's money and get a whole lot better result. So just so you know,
We understand. I just want to be responsive.
Super. The 965 units, or 965 homes, do you know, have an example or an estimate on how many people that would be? Like, because some of those are probably two, three bedroom, right?
So we actually go up to five bedrooms. So we have one to five bedroom units across this community, absolutely. And our mix from a restricted to unrestricted is about at 80-20 in terms of what we've delivered. Yeah.
And I'll just add, we've been carefully tracking the children just because that was a target, it was a goal, education was an issue. We're focused with partners on delivering those services. At the end of 2025, we're close to 500 kids, ages 0 to 18, with the two family buildings coming on. We're projecting by September of this year, 1,000 children, ages 0 to 18. So a lot of kids, we're so proud of bringing them back, and we've actually integrated that into every element of the building. There's extra closets that families said they needed for storage. There's just a lot of details from the unit on out to, you know, little nooks and playgrounds on site for buildings to accommodate families.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say is this happens to be in District 3. It could be Chair's request. It could be Ball Arena. It could be River Mile. You know, but I bring up Cherry Creek West specifically because it abuts the Cherry Creek, and so to you, Council Torres, I'm somewhat jealous that we don't have this development in District 10. And I just say, you know, as we talk, we should talk all the time about the inverted L. I really I see that this could be anywhere in the city, and so I like that we're putting quality stuff everywhere, particularly in areas that are that have seen gentrification, that have seen the effects of redlining. So thank you for doing that. Thank you for picking Sun Valley. It's a great area as we continue to build bridges, which I think is the next presentation, across our rivers. Hopefully that will create a better experience for the folks in Sun Valley who want to come downtown, maybe work downtown, or come eat, or I go to one of the sporting events downtown, and so that would make this even more desirable than it already is. So thank you. Thank you, Committee Chair.
I realize, speaking of Councilmember Torres, I forgot to welcome her to the committee meeting, Chair Torres, actually. And with that, Madam President is next in our queue.
Thank you. Thank you all. When I started my career in 2012, I was working for Councilman Montero, who we wrote the letters of support for the grant. And so just want to say that it's been one of my proudest things to work on. I remember when we adopted the Decatur and Federal Area Plan, our transit-oriented development, the Station Area Plan. It was one of the first time that kids had been part of it, and we gave them awards because they helped build out the planning process. And I remember looking at Councilwoman Montero at the time and saying, is this going to be done in our lifetime? And we didn't know about, we were just finishing up in La Alma Lincoln Park, that transformative project with Denver Housing Authority. And she looked at me and said, I don't know. Honestly, I don't. And then we got the opportunity to help you all with the grant. And a lot of work went into this project. So just want to say kudos to that. And what was I was so concerned about when I stopped working in that council district and started working for my predecessor, Councilman Espinosa, is that the people who I had made really good friendships with, that they wouldn't be able to go back into that neighborhood. They were so... It was such a community when we would go. I was welcomed into people's homes. I had Ethiopian food. I was literally welcomed into people's dining rooms. And so to have them be a national model of coming back is, I think, what should happen. And I'm happy to see how, while you've leveraged the dollars, I've been proud to support rezonings to get more density in this area. And I'll be really proud when the Army Corps of Engineers comes in and takes this area, hopefully, out of the floodplain. That's been a concern of mine, is one of the things I'll never forget, waking up in the middle of the night, call from our police commander at the time, saying a little girl had gotten out of one of the homes and went down to the riverfront park and had passed away. I think they were two or three. And I immediately started doing work, and I realized that culturally, people didn't know how to swim. And so we started offering swim lessons at Rudy Rec Center with families to make sure to help that never happen again. But it was one of the hardest things that I remember. Judy and I went to the candlelight vigil of having a little baby who just didn't know how to swim, and their parents didn't know how to swim, and people didn't realize that. So that has been something that has been near and dear to my heart. My husband grew up across the street at the Avondales, and he remembers fishing off of that bridge and going down there. And when we grew up, I grew up in the north side, he grew up in the west side, even though it's very close to each other, and we have battles with Councilman Porter. Now we're aligned, now we're all aligned. West side, north side united.
House to fight.
You didn't swim in the Platte. You didn't go to the plat. It was a place where scary things happened to people if you went down to that area. When I got elected, I specifically put my council office. My council office is 1810 Platt Street because I wanted to make sure that somebody had an eye on the development of the plat. And then when we were able to get the Army Corps engineer, at the time I went to Councilwoman Torres and said, let's do something innovative and create a new committee. And she was like, awesome, let's do it. And so just want to say that this is the heart. This is why we, I think she and I had the vision to create this committee, is if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. And sometimes when I was growing up, it felt like Sun Valley was out of sight. So it literally was out of people of mind. You could not get down into the neighborhood to be able to go access people's homes. It literally was cut off. So just want to say kudos to you and your team. It's a project of love. And as someone who serves on the executive bond committee, it's a lot of projects coming in, and I appreciate your advocacy. I appreciated you all showing up at public comment and so offering your support and making sure that the project's finished. My one question is how does this park, I've asked this question at the Executive Bond Committee, how does this park interplay with the work that the Army Corps of Engineers will do? I just don't quite understand how they work together.
So we've actually remained working with Dottie and then through them with what's happening with the Weir Gulch improvements and the Army Corps work throughout this project, because we also, even for some of our vacant land, as they're putting together their plans, we needed to understand how high the new 9th Avenue was going to be and where the the doorways and things could be, so that we don't have to do that twice. There was some land owned by DHA that we have sold to the city to be able to complete some of that work. We had a warehouse site that we demolished and things like that. So we've been a part of that work in a meaningful way for a number of years. My understanding, and then I'll ask Sean if I say anything wrong, feel free to step up to the mic, but that we are coordinating our construction schedule with what would be happening with the Weir Gulch improvements, where we've actually are taking out a part of what's on our land that needs to happen in Weir Gulch, just to make sure that we're fully aligned, and this, because this is work that we've been doing with multiple contractors out on site all at the same time, we're very used to kind of coordinating those things at this point. But that's my understanding, is that there's a little bit to the south that we won't be constructing yet into the park, so that it can be part of the Weir Gulch work, and then bringing in the specific park improvements afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And then I have Councilmember Torres next in queue.
Great, thank you so much. I'm glad President Sandoval mentioned that this was part of District 9 when a lot of the early work was created. Loma Lincoln Park, also District 9. So big kudos also to Councilwoman Montero for leading on that work. Tina Griego, back in 2016, wrote a really powerful series about Sun Valley. And I'll share the links to my colleagues in case you haven't seen these, but it really painted just an incredible portrait of the soul of Sun Valley, and also these like seemingly insurmountable challenges that neighborhood faced in built form and street grid and all of the things that I think are being, and it's so interesting to go back and see that language and see what's being built here. And yes, community had to be uprooted in order for this project to happen. What we do hope is that them being welcomed back allows them to reestablish those connections, create new ones. Community being built is a long process. And I'm grateful that you're constantly making space, like physically and philosophically, for residents to do that. That's the most important thing, I think, for people to feel like they belong somewhere. So thank you for that, that work. That's such a huge part of all of this. The elephant in the room is the school. And How much of the return, 32% of families returning, how much of that do you think was affected by those families knowing they don't have a school to send their kids to if they returned?
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg thing. We are promoting, I think, a really incredible, healthy, wholly focused neighborhood. And yet we are hearing that families are like, but there's not a school there now. A school that we built the master plan centered upon for families to easily access families where if you saw some of the data that we put up, 75% of families didn't have cars. And so older children, walking younger children to school, we're currently in a situation where children are bused to school alternative across federal and across Colfax, but four-year-olds cannot ride the bus. So we're most recently very concerned about early childhood education access. We're working with our families to determine what is the rate that families are getting children to early education without access to bus or cars. And we're working with DPS to understand, you know, if we could reuse that site, even the building, to start an EC program in cooperation with other programs in the area. We have kids at Mercy Housing as well as another child health care center, working with those providers who are at capacity to look at those needs to capture and really provide that whole picture. But yes, it is a factor in lease-up. We're hearing the families are very concerned about the lack of safe, immediate access to a school.
And to be clear, kids are going to Cheltenham in place of Fairview, maybe Eagleton, I'm not quite sure, but predominantly Cheltenham. But that should be known. And if my colleagues haven't seen or heard the chatter, I'm also hearing that DPS is offering up some of its vacant buildings for development, and Fairview is one of them, which really concerns me. My other question, if I could get follow-up, 965 homes, does that include the private development, or is that just
no,
the DHA
that's
build?
That's just the DHA, and then there'll be another 1,000 coming on the market rate side.
Thank you. Of the 965, it says 763 are between 0 and 80% area median income. Can I get that broken down too? Maybe
absolutely.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That'd
yes,
be great.
We have that for you.
And then just to follow up on the community building side, is a local resident council coming back to Sun Valley, or is that what does that model look like now?
So about that, we are not only making efforts pertaining to the Sun Valley community. We are trying to build that community engagement structure across the board in every single one of our housing complexes. So the answer to that question is yes, we are making an intentional effort to make sure that that structure will be in place in the way it should. But I want to say that this is an effort that is not only pertaining to the Sun Valley community. We are trying to make all of those efforts as well through our resident and community connections department to engage the different communities and to make sure that we can have in place local resident councils across the board.
Okay.
Which is not the reality now.
And if I could just add on to that, this is part of our iterative process, our learnings, that local resident councils, that's kind of more built into our structure of public housing. Mm-hmm. So when we have been building tax credit housing, mixed income housing that includes public housing replacement, mm-hmm. it doesn't come with that same structure. Mm-hmm. But we know that that's a similar structure is important. So that's where in a Sun Valley where we have this happening.
Evolution of it.
Exactly. Yeah. We're saying we need to take those affirmative steps to create those types of structures, even though it doesn't come kind of within the program
totally
that it typically
love
would.
That. Yeah. Thank you for thinking of that. And just my kudos. I love working with you all. I have a number of housing authority sites in District 3, and you're very responsive to questions that come up, opportunities, innovations, and just really appreciate you all as a partner. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Last in the queue, we have Councilmember Flynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I might have inferred the answer
when you respond to Councilwoman Torres, but Renee, I think it was you who mentioned that at, you know, at completion there would be 1,000-some-odd children. What was the number?
We're projecting 1,000 students that will move into the last two buildings that are leasing up. When we look at the number of bedrooms and project what we are required occupancy, we're projecting 1,000 students.
Okay, is that inclusive of the additional housing, the market rate?
No, it does not include the market rate.
But do you have an estimate for that? Because that feeds into schools.
We could get you that. The number, the 1,000 does include the kids that we can count right now who are in place, the number that will lease up, the number of kids at Mercy Housing as well. And so that includes those kids. It does not include the market rate, which will have a little bit of a lower yield on students, on kids below the age of 18. Okay. Just across the city, market rate units tend to yield much lower.
Let me make sure I understand. 1,000 0 to 18 children, 965 homes that are yours. Mm-hmm. That's only like one child per home. That doesn't compute if you have 2, 3, 4, and 5 bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't that be a higher number of children?
There's a fair amount of one bedrooms there.
Okay.
And it is a modest number. We don't want to overproject.
Okay. Yes.
And very soon, by the end of the year, we'll be able to bring you numbers that are actual children in place.
Okay. Could you provide us then with a breakdown of the 965 by bedroom?
Yes.
Number. Thanks.
So yeah, we'll add that. One of our takeaways is to provide all of the 965 units by AMI, and so we'll do it by bedroom as well and just give you the full unit mix as a combined. We tend to have it by building, but we'll kind of roll those up for you.
It just seemed to me that with that many units, that many homes, that there should be a higher estimate for numbers of children.
Yeah. It will include our projections on the number.
I know that's not up to you to produce the children.
Just produced a couple.
What I will say,
I'm not asking for that.
What I will say, which is the undeniable truth, is that once we deliver the whole complex, 7 buildings, including those that are going to be for family compositions and housing children and the likes, right? The level of density that we will have there, for which the Fairview Elementary will be necessary, will far exceed what was in place, let's say, 5, 10 years ago. That is the undeniable truth. And I think that to the conversation and what Councilwoman Torres was making reference and the question that you're asking, and totally understand, and we are going to provide that information, that is what we are seeing, and that is what is spearheading the discussions that we're having, for example, with DPS, and to make sure that we can keep gaining traction there.
Okay.
The numbers are there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Council Pro Tem Ramon Campbell.
Oh, I'll just go really quick because I know we're running low on time. Thank you for the presentation. It's really exciting, and you know, big kudos to Council Members Torres and Sandoval for having worked on this for such a long time. I think that there are multiple opportunities, and I'm sure you're working on them, and intersections that need to happen for early childhood within the larger early childhood community and systems, with the Early Childhood Council, with the Office of Children's Affairs, but also very concerning for DPS to offer up that building. And I think that would be, to me, a topic that would be surfacing for our DPS and Council Collaborative Committee for an urgent conversation, because I think that as we're looking at use, we know what the use and the need is, and with the housing that goes around it. So anyway, I could go off a little bit on this one, but very interested in working with you or collaborating for some of those strategies around the early childhood community and how, and I know that there are providers there, Mile High and on Decatur, et cetera, all around within the community, but more than willing to lean into a conversation around that support around an early childhood network for Sun Valley. And I know that the Sun Valley Youth Center does a tremendous amount of work, but often works with the, you know, they're working with some older, they're working with elementary and middle school and high school kids for that. So anyway, I just wanted to
say that real quick, put it out there. And so thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
Yeah, thank you. All right, so much appreciation for this. I will hold my questions so we can get to our second presentation, but this has been super illuminating and very much appreciated. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank
you all. Thanks. So as we transition, we will have the team from Dottie coming up here to present on South Platte River bridges.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy birthday again.
It's just denvergov.org/bridges.
There's a zipper thing going on.
Okay. It's a live one because
I can do it.
You just click the three dots. Present.
Awesome.
Okay. Okay. There you go.
Appreciate it.
All right, Department of Transit and Infrastructure friends, you guys want to introduce yourselves and start your presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Brad Chamberlain. I'm an engineer and manager for the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure. And I'm going to be presenting today with Jennifer Williams. She's also an engineer and principal project manager within our infrastructure team. So first and foremost, I want to thank the South Platte River Committee for having us here today. We're excited to present a bridge condition update for bridges owned by the City and County of Denver.
Thanks, Brad. So I'm going to kick things off, talk a little bit about bridge condition, bridge overview, a little bit about the statistics, and a little bit of background to help set the stage for the rest of the presentation. And then I'll kick things back over to Brad. He's going to give a little update on some South Platte River successes that we've had in the last few years, talk a little bit about citywide needs that we have. And then we'll wrap things up, hopefully, with a demonstration of the condition dashboard that we have posted externally. If I can manage that technology. Just a little bit about bridges in the city. So the City and County of Denver, we own about 650 bridges citywide. These are split by different agencies. So Dottie and DPR own the most bridges. Dottie has about 400 bridges. Those are typically vehicular bridges. We do have a couple pedestrian, but think vehicular bridges when you think of Dottie. DPR and Gulf, their trail system, a regional trail system, and any of the bridges within our parks. So they're typically more bike and ped. Arts and Venues does have a few bridges, which may surprise some folks that are watching online, but the Convention Center and Red Rocks do have some bridges as well. NUCO also, with some of the redevelopment in the last few years, has added a few more additional bridges into our inventory. We've had a ton of growth since the 1940s. We've only had 53 bridges, which is kind of hard to believe for an entire city of Denver, but we've grown pretty significantly over the last few decades to the 650-ish number that I mentioned earlier. So that growth is primarily driven by Dottie and DPR, so development in the Northeast, Central Park, Lowry, Green Valley Ranch. So growth in those areas contributed a lot of bridges, as well as our trail systems building out South Platte River Trail, Cherry Creek, Sand Creek, all those systems also added a lot of inventory. So we've certainly grown as a city when it comes to bridge inventory. So the typical bridge workflow, I know we've had lots of conversations. If Councilman Cashman was here, I'm sure we'd have lots to offer here. But we do have these different owners of the different bridges and the different areas of town, right? And so it can be a little confusing when we have so many owners of this inventory. Dottie is responsible for all of the bridge inspections. We are the subject matter experts when it comes to those types of things, when it comes to safety and emergency closures. We're your go-to. When it comes to finding funding for projects, it's going to be up to the individual agency owner to find funding for those projects. And then once the funding is allocated or found, then project implementation kicks back to Dottie for delivery, design, and implementation of projects. And that's how it currently stands now from the funding aspect. So I'm going to try and give you a few just overview of definitions and some details that are that will be more helpful as we talk about when Brad talks about some of the projects that we've recently done and what they mean, and then some of the needs that we have coming up for the bridges. So I'll kind of start on the right-hand side at the top, anatomy of a bridge. So we talk a lot about bridge deck. That's the part that you walk on or drive on or bike on. We talk a lot about superstructures and substructures. So superstructure, kind of think of the part above the bridge or the bridge itself. So the bridge deck, and whatever the supporting structures are above it, if it's an arch or a, you know, like a railroad truss bridge, got a lot of those in along Cherry Creek. And then the girders, which are kind of the horizontal support underneath the bridge. We also have the substructure, which are the abutments, those little pieces on the end that are kind of holding the ground back. Also said that setting the bridge on top of it. That's the substructure, and the foundation is, of course, what, you know, is tying us to the ground. Two other pieces that you may hear mentioned later are some other components are expansion joints and bearings. And those are the pieces that help the bridge move, because the bridge is, you know, inherently going to change when it gets hotter or colder. And we want that flexibility in the bridge. So we have this lovely bridge here, and we are always talking to all of you guys about how they're in poor condition. This one's in poor condition. That one's in poor condition. Well, how do we know? Well, it's very prescriptive is what I would say, which is great, because then, you know, you can go anywhere in the country and you know whether a bridge is in good condition, in fair condition, or in poor condition. So it's a rating system, National Bridge Inventory 0 to 9. It's very prescriptive, so everyone's using the same thing. So if a bridge is rated at a specific 4 or lower, then it's going to be a poor condition. So we have inspections that validate this information for us. And how often do we do it? So for vehicular bridges, we do it every 2 years. And then for pet bridges, we do it every 3 years. And then once we have a bridge that kind of starts to get in that tricky situation where we think we just want to monitor it a little more closely, we can monitor it every year just to make sure that, you know, it's not getting worse than we thought on a faster schedule, so we can close it or do whatever we need to. And again, it's just, it's very prescriptive, I think, which is important to know, I think. Some key definitions that we also toss around quite a bit are structurally deficient. And so what that means is that one of those major components, either the deck, the superstructure, substructure, or possibly all three, are poorly rated or in a poorly rated condition. And it doesn't mean it's going to fall into the water or on a railroad or whatever the case may be, but it does mean that we need to be thinking about how can we maintain it in the interim and get to a final solution where we haven't likely in a new structure in place someday in the future. So it's kind of getting into that, you know, we need to be thinking about a plan phase. We often talk about the ASE Bridge Report Card, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that on the next slide. I'm sure you guys have seen that. It's American Society of Civil Engineers. They release this infrastructure report. It talks about storm, sanitary, wastewater treatment plants, aviation. It talks about all infrastructure nationally and how we kind of rank within those different categories. So we'll talk a little bit about how we fit in the bridge world there. And final definition is load-restricted, sometimes called load-posted bridges. And those are bridges that can't, that have a designation that limits the weight of vehicles that can traverse that bridge. So on the right-hand side there, bringing up Councilman Cashman again, these bridges are along Harvard Gulch, and they have been load-restricted. So you can see the typical sign. You'll see a weight limit. It has little vehicles on it, and then it tells you what the most amount of weight that can travel on that bridge. And there's different reasons that it can be load posted or load restricted. Maybe the road's too narrow, or maybe it just physically can't handle the weight of the live load. But it is a problem, and Brad's going to talk a little bit later about future liabilities. So how are we as an agency? So where it is, city and county of Denver. And on the right-hand side, these numbers, I do want to point out, these are vehicular numbers. These do not include any inventory from PED inventory. So Denver has about 13.8 of our inventory, vehicular inventory, is rated as structurally deficient. So the American Society of Civil Engineers would give us a D-. I'm not familiar with that grade, personally, but
she's like, I was never a T minus.
You've never
got a T minus? No, I've never got. Like, even the thought of it gives me like heart palpitations, and I'm a long way out of school. I will say that Minneapolis and Austin, some of our sister cities, they are doing much better in the bridge space. More I like to roll, you know, the A minus categories. If you look at CDOT, they've really done a lot of work the last few years to get their structurally deficient number down. So they're at 5.4%. Nationally, we're a little bit higher than that, but still slightly better than us. But you know, it's good to have goals. So as I mentioned, citywide, 650 structures. The average age is about 38 years. And on a typical year, we get about $7 million of funding. The Capital Planning and Programming 2024 Infrastructure Report, they did denote that there was a gap between how much funding we would need to stay in a state of good repair for all of our bridge infrastructure, including parks, bridges, and vehicular bridges. And I think it's more important to note that that's really this like continued investment in some of the rehab, or I don't know if you want to call it like resiliency projects or
preservation
projects. Thanks, Brad. That when they're in that fair condition, we really want to continue to invest in them in the fair preservation type category, because it keeps them from dropping into poor, into structurally deficient. So it's really gives us the best, like a lot of bang for our buck, even though it's not maybe as glamorous as some of the other projects that we do. And then I will kind of turn it over to our South Platte River inventory and then turn it to Brad to talk about our recent investments. But we do have 42 structures along the South Platte River, bridges. The average age is the same as the citywide infrastructure, 38 years old. And we have recently done 6 projects, and I'll turn it over to Brad to talk about those.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. So the next slide here is talking about recent successes along the South Platte River. And as Jennifer noted, there's really two types of projects that we try to focus on. The first ones are preservation-based projects, and those are taking assets, as she mentioned, that are in either fair or good condition, and trying to do preventative maintenance work to elongate the serviceability life of the bridge. So I like to equate it, if you own a home, you know, you've got to replace your roof every certain amount of years to keep the water out. Bridges are not that different. Water's one of the worst things that obviously leads to a lot of the decay in our bridges that gets the bridge to that poor rating. And once a bridge reaches that poor rating, you really can't get it back. So you really have to look for that replacement as the option. And so to highlight the first three projects that fall into that category, and some of these you might have seen over the last few years, the first one is on the far upper left there. That's the Park Avenue Viaduct Complex. So if you're familiar with that bridge structure, it was built in the early 90s, actually by the FHWA and CDOT. It was turned over to the city upon completion. We invested about $15 million combination of CIP and Elevate funds into that bridge. Just to give you kind of a frame of reference, if we were to build that bridge in today's dollars, it would be about $250 million. And so we really feel that $15 million investment is going to go a long way for this organization, because what it'll do on the back end is really give us a guaranteed 30 additional serviceability year life out there where we can run that bridge with minimal impacts to the citizens and push out that major capital cost for a couple decades. So a very similar approach on our 20th Street project. That was fully funded by our CIP program, but same approach. We took a bridge built in the early 90s, doing the preservation forward for that. On the lower left there, you see the iconic Spear Arch bridges. There's a series of 6 bridges between the Platte River and Ball Arena. And so we did major rehabilitations to all 6 of those structures. And again, that was partially Elevate, partially our CIP program. And then the last project here that I wanted to highlight is our 8th Avenue over the South Platte River bridge replacement project. And so for those that were familiar with the bridge that was there before, the original bridge was built in the early 1900s, and it served our city very well, but it had reached the point where There was no additional maintenance treatments that we could do to keep it safe and reliable, and replacement was our only option. But the structure that's there today, mostly thanks to our Elevate bond program, will likely serve our citizens well for the next 75 years. The project also was able to make major mobility improvements across 8th Avenue, as well as reconstruct the South Platte River Trail through the project site, pulling it outside of the floodplain. So we saw a lot of really excellent benefits along with the structure replacement. Next slide here. So for this next slide here, we want to really focus on our top really citywide bridge needs within the City and County Denver's inventory. And so I'm going to highlight five projects here. The first two projects are at our 6th Avenue Viaducts and 8th Avenue Viaducts over the Burnham Yard, if you're familiar with the old rail yard there. So the first two are really to focus on access and connectivity needs for that future re-envision of that area and how the viaducts could still play a role in that. And so that's what the first two projects are. The third one is 6th Avenue and Lincoln Street over Cherry Creek. So if you're familiar, this is pretty close to the Denver Health campus down there. But we have two bridges that are basically perpendicular to each other. They were built in the 50s, and they're at the end of their serviceability life. Lincoln Street, you can see in the middle picture right there, we actually had a partial deck failure about a year ago. And we're tracking another location in that bridge where we can potentially have another emergency repair. But at this point, there's really nothing we can do besides just band-aiding it. Replacement's really our only option, and we're getting to that point where we think the reliability of that infrastructure is really decreasing, and we appreciate the sensitive nature with the hospital and whatnot surrounding that. Both bridges, I should also mention, as Jennifer showed previously, are at risk of being load restricted, meaning that heavier commercial and emergency vehicles might be restricted from using those bridges moving forward. The fourth project, is our Smith Road and Sandown Road over Quebec. This is in our Central Park neighborhood. Again, these are bridges built in the 50s that are at the end of their service life. We actually just found out yesterday that these bridges will be load posted this year, meaning that the industrial area that those bridges serve, there could be major impacts to trucks that are able to use those bridges to access Quebec Street. So again, infrastructure that's starting to get to the end of its reliability and service life, so that we need to have that plan to get those replaced. And then our last project that I wanted to highlight today is Quebec Street over Erlon. This is actually in the same vicinity as the Smith and Sandown. Again, if you're familiar with this location, it's basically Quebec Street immediately north of I-70. Erlon Road is actually not a road, but it's an old abandoned railroad spur. And this bridge is really at the end of its service life. And again, we just need to replace it. And we are working to understand if it needs to be load posted. We don't have definitive answers at this point, but we do feel it's a risk. So those are our current needs. And then the last thing we wanted to highlight, if we can have a few more minutes of your time, over the last year, my team has been working on an interactive website and dashboard here to really have one-stop shop for all things bridges within the City and County of Denver's ownership. And so the webpage has current links to ongoing projects that we're doing as far as rehabilitations and replacements. We also have information. We do have a few pedestrian bridges closed due to their structural conditions. So we've got information, detours, and project information you can find there. But the one thing we wanted to highlight here, and you can really drill down to virtually the condition of any bridge with the City and County of Denver here with this dashboard that we've stood up. And the dashboard is directly connected to our asset management system. So all the data is live based on the latest inspections. And so we thought we'd like to highlight one of the council districts. And then, this is sortable for any council district, and we'd be happy to walk anyone through it at a later date if there's interest. But to focus on Council District 7 here, If you click on the lower right side of the box, like Jennifer did, it automatically sorts just the data for Council District 7. And then all the data and the graphs and numbers above is, again, just focused on that council district alone. The really interesting part, at least to myself as a structural engineer, is you can go in and you can see all the different diamonds, essentially, throughout our network there. Those correlate to bridge locations that we have in our inventory. And similar to like a traffic signal, red is rated in poor condition or structurally deficient. Yellow is those bridges in fair condition, and green are the likely the newer ones that are still in good condition. And as you can see, there's the giant kind of closed symbol on the upper right-hand side that is delineating a closed pedestrian bridge due to its structural condition. And so if you hover over any one of those boxes and click it, it'll actually show you advanced data on that bridge. So we feel this way, our data is transparent to the citizens, council, anyone that wants further information on our bridge health. So with that, I'll conclude this presentation and thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. I feel like I had enough things to like have nightmares about and keep up the night, but I'll just peruse this dashboard for even more material. And I'm really glad you guys came in today. We have a queue starting with Councilmember Flynn.
Thank you. When I was a transportation writer at the Rocky Mountain News, I wrote about the Federal Boulevard Bridge over Lakewood Gulch. There was part of the W Line construction. And when you went under that bridge, it was just appalling. And I think I wrote something along the lines of, if you could drive under some of these bridges, you would never drive over them. Uh-huh. So my question has to do with something like that. On Federal Boulevard State Highway, that was a CDOT project. And you referenced CDOT and said they have a 5.4% structurally deficient compared to our rate, which is 2.5 times that at least. But they have 35 plus or minus 100 bridges in the state. Can you isolate CDOT's inventory just for City and County of Denver? Because I would like to see what is their performance in the city. I frequently get calls about the condition of the state highways in city that are actually city streets, but they're state highways. So our ability to do anything to improve them, like Federal Boulevard, which is a washboard, we have very little that we can do with them. So I'd like to see a drill down on CDOT's data just for City and County of Denver. Is that possible?
I could ask our peers at CDOT if they'd be willing to provide that.
I'm sure it'll be happy to do that.
I think you bring up another really excellent point, though, as far as, as a driver driving on a bridge structure, you're looking most of the time at asphalt that looks reasonably well-placed, right?
Assuming you're not texting, right?
Yeah, assuming you're not texting, that's an excellent point. Assuming your eyes are on the road. But I think the thing that a lot of people miss is really it takes going underneath this infrastructure to really understand its structural, as far as, how it's doing structurally. And I think we have a lot of bridges that present well from the driving surface, but really the importance is looking underneath. And hope the dashboard that we are sharing with everyone today gives you some insight to that, what is underneath the bridge, to your point.
That's much appreciated. And I think CDOT, maybe the lesson to learn here is CDOT's bridges used to be in a lot worse shape until, I believe, the FASTER program under Governor Ritter.
Yep.
And the bridge fee on our registration. And I recall that some of the first replacements they did were bridges along old Highway 96 in southeast Colorado, which is parallel to US 50, little used two-lane highway, but the 5 bridges there were built in the Depression, and they were built with wood stringers. And so because of that bridge fee, I think CDOT's been able to make a lot of progress. I don't know if there's a comparable vehicle for Denver.
To answer your question, a couple of thoughts there. So at the time, I've been at the city and county now for 9 years. Prior to that, I worked as a consultant for CDOT, so I worked on a lot of the programs you previously mentioned. And
you might remember those.
I'm very familiar and worked on some of the timber bridge replacements. And so I think there's a lot of parallels of, some of the great work that they did under those programs you mentioned And obviously the bridge enterprise being one of the big key ones, which is still ongoing to this date. And that bridge enterprise program has grown a lot since when it was initially conceived back under, I think at that point it might have been Hickenlooper. What the bridge enterprise started at was a program designed to solve for structurally deficient bridges and to find a path to get those off the inventory. It still continues to do that to this day. They also do preservation as well as tunnel work within that. So it's grown over the years to make sure that all infrastructure is being taken care of, appreciating everything's important for us to get from point A to point B safely. I think your answer is there a direct relation between the Bridge Enterprise Program to what we have here at the City and County of Denver. I can say that at this point, really the funding sources that are made available to us is either the CIP program, which we said, you know, we've been averaging around $7 million. And if you saw the previous slide, as far as our recent successes, a bridge replacement in today's dollars, so like say 8th over Platt, that was actually bid before COVID. So some of the price inflationary pressures that we've seen, that project might have even cost more in today's dollars than it did then. That being said, you know, it's really the bond initiatives or the CIP program, understanding CIP is really where we focus more preservation work, because that's just where we can afford based on our funding levels.
Yes, more widely. Yep. It would be great then if we could get from CDOT what is their level of effort in Denver City and County. If they have a 5.4% structurally deficient statewide, is it higher in Denver? And does that indicate their level of effort needs to be increased here in City and County? I would love to have that data. Because when we drive down a road, sometimes we're going over a Denver bridge, it's our problem. Yep. But a lot of times we're going over a CDOT bridge.
We can absolutely ask them.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Who do I have next? Council President Sandoval.
Thank you so much. So if you could go to the one slide that you have, the one of the last slides that you had with the list of the bridges on there. It had 8th Avenue Viaduct, 6th Avenue Viaduct, 6th Avenue over Cherry Creek. So how are those rated? Did I miss, like, if you had to rate those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which would be the worst? Like, how do I know? Does that make sense?
That's a great question. I think there's really two different workflows that we're seeing within this list. I don't know, Elena, if you want to weigh in as well, but one of the workflows is really a reconfiguration for connectivity to a...
No, I know that. That's not what I'm asking. Okay. I'm asking rating them. So you said a D minus.
Yep. Oh, okay.
What rating? Not that kind of, like, I understand how they would work. I'm not trying to ask for, like, the scoping. I'm asking if you had to rate them, which one would be the, are they in order of, is the 6th Avenue over Barnum the worst? And then the 8th is the worst, and then the 6th is the worst. And if they are the worst, like, what rating are they? Like, how bad? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. The short answer is, if we're going to rate it based on its structural issues, the worst set is 6th and Lincoln, followed by Smith Sandown, followed by Quebec and Erlon.
So for the, it's the, I have to write that because I'll never remember. So it's the 6th Avenue over Lincoln. So the 6th Avenue over the Cherry Creek. And how, what, how, if I had to convey that back, why is it the worst? Does that make sense?
Yep. No, it's a few
so
different.
You said 6th, sorry, and then which one?
So we actually have two bridge replacements lumped as one project based on kind of the overall needs and impact. And so the third one down would be the highest structural reliability issue.
Okay.
And so that is 6th Avenue, as you mentioned, over Cherry Creek, Lincoln Street over Cherry Creek. So two discrete bridges there. Really what we're dealing with.
Next one, sorry, I didn't write them down in order.
Sandown.
So then the second one would be.
Sandown.
Smith Road and Sandown, so two parallel bridges over Quebec Street. And so, and then the third would be Erlon and Quebec. But the, really the risks are a variety, for a variety of different reasons. So like I said, Lincoln Street, the deck is in poor condition. And we're tracking other locations where we might have potential isolated deck failures. But when a bridge is of that age and you start having these types of failures, there's really not many other maintenance ways that we can go in to improve the resiliency of this bridge. And it really comes down to just a deteriorating bridge at the end of its life. Sixth Avenue has similar issues, but in the girder system. And the Smith and Sandown bridges have issues within their girder systems, and that's why we're advocating for that replacement.
And what about the 6th Avenue Viaduct over Burnham and the 8th Avenue Viaduct over Burnham? How, what's their life?
I'll let him talk to the structural deficiencies and readability, but I will say that what you're seeing on this slide, oh, I'm sorry, yes. Elena McWhorter, Dottie legislative liaison. But what you're seeing on this slide is combining both those urgent structural health and safety needs as well as the future development needs. Yeah.
You probably want to know right now because they're all on the bond. I need to figure out which ones are like super safe, because I've been told what I've been presented is different than what you're presenting here. And so I just want to make sure I'm understanding what's accurate.
So the 6th Avenue Viaducts were built in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And they are, again, reaching the end of their lifespans, but we still believe that they have about 15 years left in, of life left in them. It will, when those bridges do require replacement, it's going to be a very expensive project if they're rebuilt in the same configuration. That being said, I don't have the answers to the development underneath, and I'm not sure how they're going to be reconfigured if and when that time comes. But the bridges do have, since they were built many, many decades ago, they do have their vulnerabilities, but those vulnerabilities are not of immediate concern, and we continue to monitor those bridges. And what I can say to you is that they're safe and they're not a must replace right now. But again, we're not advocating for replacement based on that.
And then I think I just got an email. I don't know, because I'm like a little bit behind my emails. I think is it 8th Avenue that's being paved right now?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can speak to 8th Avenue. It's a very interesting bridge. It was built
it's
in.
It's super interesting. I mean, I've taken it for years. And it used to be the council aid. My council member used to. Councilman Montero, and I'd be like, okay, this bridge is a trip.
Yeah. From a structural standpoint, you might, you know, as you drive across it, you might notice very large vertical and horizontal curvature of that structure. The bridge, when it was built in the 80s, was built with a very, I'd say, cutting-edge design back then. And what was done was it's all one structural frame. And when you have a bridge of very complex geometry, a lot of times, as structural engineers, we like to make the problem slightly less complex by breaking it up into multiple frames. And if you think about kind of what Jennifer said earlier, when we think about bearings and expansion joints, these individual frames, because the bridge is going to move when it heats up, think steel, you know, obviously expands, cold, it contracts. And so the bridge will move. It's just how do we engineer in a way that moves based on how we want it to, not how it just will if you don't account for it correctly. And so with this cutting edge design back in the 80s, when there wasn't as much advanced modeling as there is today, let's just say that they didn't get everything right. And so the bridge has had some structural issues over the years that we've been working on an ongoing basis to address. And so there was a project under the Elevate portfolio to do a lot more of the structural type work. We scaled some of that back, understanding some of, you know, the potential redevelopment opportunities at Burnham. We made some decisions to move some of the money there to other really critical issues throughout the city and continue to monitor. The reason we did pave and the reason we did replace the expansion joints is because we felt there's an immediate safety risk to having, the HMA had a lot of potholes. We were aware of a couple accidents related to that. We had an accident related to one of the expansion joints. And we wanted to make sure that was first and foremost safe until the bridge was ready to be reconfigured. And so it was really a safety-related decision. I can assure you that we did make decisions on that overlay to make it as inexpensive as possible, understanding the bridge's time might be pretty limited, if that helps answer your question.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Councilmember Torres.
Thank you so much. When I got my briefing a while back, I was like, we have to get this in front of the committee. So I really appreciate the dashboard being up. I think that's really easy to find and follow for us and for residents. So I really appreciate that. The one thing I'd like to pick up on that Councilman Flynn mentioned, the number of highway bridges like 6th Avenue, Perry and Knox Court in my district. Perry is like, I think I'd value like where CDOT grades those bridges as well, because that's one that I know is just, it feels old.
Over 6th Avenue?
Over 6th, Perry, yeah.
That's right, it's tractually deficient.
There you go, okay.
I've looked that one up myself.
Yeah.
I've wondered. Yep.
And the difficulty, too, is we've actually gotten a CDOT grant to do improvements under the federal bridge where the West Line kind of the Lakewood Gulch run under. And it's been really difficult to actually even get the improvements in because it is a CDOT bridge. And so I like, it is just such a challenging space for us to try to do something in those spaces when they're owned and maintained by CDOT. So I can appreciate like the universe is really difficult in some of these things.
Absolutely. And I'm aware of the lighting project. I've tried to help where I can there. And
thank you.
We've advocated behind the scenes at CDOT and yeah, they're a totally different organization. So it can be challenging.
Very good. Most of my other, I think, detailed questions were asked and answered. And so just really appreciate this. I am interested in, I take very competitively that Austin, Texas has more bridges than us and they're doing way a lot better than us. How are they funding that? Like, I'd love to figure out if there is a different way that we find pathways for funding for things like bridges, because you cannot just close 6th Avenue. You can't just close Colfax Viaduct. Like, we really do have to pay attention to these overpasses.
You bring up an excellent point. We've worked with Councilman Cashman to answer some of the bridge closure issues within his district. And one of the kind of important things that you said there is when we reach the point of the bridge being closed due to its structural condition, there's a lot of permitting and design that takes place. And that can take, you know, upwards of 2 to 4 years, depending on the complexity of the project. So getting ahead of these potential closures is of utmost importance.
Right.
To your point.
Yeah. Thank you both for so much.
So because our committee room clock is slightly wrong, I'm going to ask one question. It's 2:56. Okay. On the slide that says that there's a year-over-year gap, like our spending has been about $7 million and there's an additional $22 million of need, that gap would be to do what exactly? Like if we were spending that, we would keep any more bridges from becoming critical? I don't think we'd be spending that and getting an A. What is that gap describing?
I think it would be really twofold. It would be standing up a more robust pedestrian bridge replacement program. It would also be being able to fund, you know, potentially through, say, a year-over-year allocation to replace some of these bridges outside of, say, major other investments that the city may decide to do, like a bond initiative. But we could be doing those on a more of a rolling basis as opposed to waiting for a bigger opportunity.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. That was illuminating. Really appreciate you guys. We have two items on consent. And with that, we're done. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. That's great.